Diversity.
You have caused confusion.
Oh, trash is more of it.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Apologies, I'm a little bit late. I was interrupted by some texts and phone calls. And also, as a result of said texts and phone calls, I'm going to have to cut the stream short as well. So we're almost certainly going to go into a part two next week and possibly even a part three the week afterwards, because old Blamblas Britannica and Rory have released not just one, but two videos on Elite Theory. I thought they were quite interesting, and I shall be responding to them. But first of all, I must respond to claims that this image here, which is on the front cover, is AI generated. I'll have you know it is not AI generated. That is actually me. That is actually Blamblas Britannica. And to prove to you that these are real images, here is another shot from the same photo shoot. There I am throwing the punch, as you can see. And here is Blamblas reeling. Like, do you remember when it was game over in Street Fighter? Do you remember? And they did the countdown. That voiceover would come in. 20, 19, 18, 17, etc. So they are actually real pictures. So there it is. What is all of this about? Why am I delivering such a knockout blow to Blamblas? Well, the reason is because Rory and has written these two articles taking aim at the quote unquote Elite Theory right, and Blamblas then read them out read out large portions of them and gave some kind of real-time analysis. And I thought it would be a useful exercise to go to kind of give a kind of response to these, to see, you know, what is fair and what is not. The first thing I want to say, though, is that, I said this on Substack, there is no such thing as the quote-unquote Elite Theory right. What are we even talking about? What is the Elite Theory right? It doesn't exist. Talking about me, I'm just a bloke in a room. I'm just a bloke here in my study. You know what I mean? The extent to which I count as quote unquote right is up for debate. Or let's say you include Scrump and Evelyn. What, you're talking about me, Scrump and Evelyn? That is not like a thing. That's just three individuals. Or let's say you include Blamblas in it as well. That's still only four individuals. You're not actually talking about anything in particular. You're just talking about some people that have talked about Elite Theory in books and on the internet. I have always said that the correct lens to view online activity of this kind is simply a league of moderately interesting color commentators. Right, I will repeat that: a league of moderately interesting color commentators. Now, I've been saying that for years, years and years, and still nobody pays any heed to this. I have been saying since 2022. I reiterated all these points in the introduction to book Applied Elite Theory. Okay, at the start of Applied Elite Theory, I reiterated the dissident right does not exist. It is not a thing. It isn't, you know, okay, some people may have met up and talked in a room, right, in a conference hall or something, or somebody may have given a presentation. That does not magically transform the fact that really what we're dealing with is a cohort of moderately interesting color commentators. So there's almost like a category error that has gone on. And, this first article that we're going to be looking at I think is more or less saying this in a nutshell. But the reason I thought it's worth responding to is because whenever anybody uses the terms elite theory, I think automatically most people think of me, because I wrote Populist Illusion, and they think, well, they must be talking about AA. I think it's kind of useful exercise to go through this. Before we get going, I found out just before we came on there that there's this new show that's on, right? There's this new show that's on, starring aforementioned Blam Blas Britannica, Harry from the Lotus Eaters, Scrump from aforementioned Scrump and Evelyn, and Aidan Paladin, I think, is that the show? But I forgot what that show is on. I forgot what that show or what it's called. I've not listened to it, but it looked of interest. Can anybody share the link? It's called Overcast. The show is called Overcast. And I would like to link it. Where is it? Show me the Overcast. Because, you know, there's a dearth of stuff. There's really a dearth of kind of non-slop content to listen to. Oh, here it is. Okay, so I'll just give it some exposure. I've not listened to it, but given that we're dealing with, a league of moderately interesting color commentators, Aristocratic Utensil, Aidan Paladin, Blam Blas Britannica, Harry, the Lotus Eater, and Scrump, I thought I'd kind of give it a little plug in my quest to bring uplift in everybody's life. That's what I do these days. Academic agent mindset, remember? Anyway, in the service of that, I will play my ad, promo code Scorcher. Then when we come back, we're going to be reviewing the first of two videos from Blam Blas. I don't know if we're going to get through it all, because I actually have to be back home by 6 o'clock or before 6 o'clock, which means I need to leave enough time to drive there. So kind of, you know, by about four, a little bit past four, we have to get out of here. So we're going to be cutting it fine today. But there is still 2 days, 3 days, in fact, to take advantage of promo code Scorcher. That's gets you 25% off all courses. Buy it now. Pick up the Trivium. The absolute best way to min-max it, if you buy the Ultra Bundle with promo code Scorcher, you're getting huge amounts of money off. So that would be the kind of pro gamer move. It's your last chance to take advantage of a sale until Halloween, which is quite a way away. So buy it now. And when I come back, we're going to watch Blam Blas. It's the Academic Agency Summer Sale. Use the promo code Scorcher. 25% off all courses. Scorcher. Get it now. Scorcher. 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 Promo code Scorcher. 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 Buy it now. All right, so let us bring up the Blam Blas video. We'll bring it up now. It's called the Organization Problem of the Elite Theory Right.
Thanks to Simon, JJ, and all other channel members. Hello, hello, hello. A seemingly perennial complaint among our circles in the British right is that, for all the knowledge we have about the function and structure of power, we've done very little to build lasting power ourselves. Outside of probably just the one large volunteer-based organisation responsible for things like Wilfing's Publishing and The Witten, which, by the way, I'm speaking at next month, and perhaps a handful of standalone things too, there are practically no lasting structures or organisations on the right.
So, it's worth mentioning from the get-go that elite theory is a descriptive, analytical, and largely speaking, academic tool for describing what is, not what ought to be, remember? And I have reiterated time and time again over the years that I am just a scholar. that you know, we are the you know, all of these names and labels people come up with are nothing. It is simply just, as I said, a group of mildly interesting color commentators. And I actually think things started going wrong, right? They started going wrong when people mistook this for political action. People routinely mistake online commentary for political action. So it may well be that me, Rory, and Blamblas end up agreeing with more, because these are all things that I've been saying for years anyway. Right, Elite Theory is not an instruction manual for how to overthrow the state. Elite Theory is a description of why the House usually wins and why peasant revolts and rebellions have usually, more often than not, come to nothing in history, and why power is everywhere and always top down. In fact, there's been another couple of ballasts against Elite Theory by some other dude. I started what, in fact, he made two videos. It was kind of funny. He made the first video, which was, it came up on my feed because it was literally called The Populist Illusion by me, Nima Barvini. And then he made a video like a week later where he's like, oh, I thought about it. And he kind of moderated his position, which is usual because Elite Theory causes a lot of cognitive dissonance in people, and it causes, it wants to kind of destroy the sacred cows that you've grown up with. Well, this chap should remember that I wrote a whole book called The Defenders of Liberty. I've been down the whole road of the Anglo tradition and, you know, the common law and Magna Carta and all of that. I've already been down the road of trying to cope and trying to, that was the whole book, Defenders of Liberty. I wrote that 10 years ago now, pretty much. And that was my attempt to try to rescue all those concepts. But in the end, basically, I had to admit I was coping. And a lot of what Elite Theory does is it confronts you with your own copes. Right? You can weave all sorts of narratives about, you know, the ancient freedom of the Briton and, you know, how the king was not above the law and all that. But it's just nonsense. It's like, oh, yeah, over there in Rome and over there in the continent, they worked this way. But here in Blighty, it worked a different way. No, it fucking didn't. It worked the same way everywhere. What the difference was is that different lies were told. The people told themselves, or the intellectuals told different lies in Britain from the sorts of lies they told in the continent. The justifications for what was happening were different. But they absolutely, you know, I mean, there's a whole, in Foundations of Shakespeare, last book I wrote, I went back and I had a look at the Norman Conquest, and I had a look at, you know, one of the all-time administrative geniuses, right, in history, I would argue, William the Bastard, William the Conqueror. And, you know, you can absolutely not tell me that the imposition of chivalric codes by William the Conqueror was not a top-down imposition. Of course it bloody was. Where he was wise is that he was able to kind of incorporate aspects of things that had already existed, like the old parishes and, you know, a few of the old baronial titles and the shire system and things like that. But do not kid yourself that Britain was some kind of bottom up people-led, just absolute nonsense, which shows an extraordinary lack of understanding of basic history. So, yeah, it's the time for these kind of romantic, capital R romantic copes about, you know, oh, Britain is different and all of that. it just needs to be entirely shed. Let's not forget that the elite theorists were coming from a kind of scientific, non-metaphysical point of view of just stubbornly seeing reality as it is, no matter what people said. Right? In many ways, this is a very different orientation from the German idealists, from Spengler and from Evola and people like that, who saw things, you know, who always see the metaphysical, transcendent, divine, and Carlyle. And yet, all of those people, Evola, Carlyle, etc., would not buy into any of these copes about the so-called individualist eternal freedom of the Anglo. These kind of, I mean, this is a story Kevin McDonald likes to tell as well. And the fact of the matter is that it's putting a rather rosy gloss on what English history and British history actually is. Anyway, I will not be spending that much time rebutting that other dude. I just thought it was worth saying. Let's let Blamblast continue here.
Now, I've been speaking with Rory, the guy behind the Islander magazine that Lotus Eater sells, and also the guy who shone a spotlight on...
Yeah, Richard Crook. I can see Richard Crook in the chat. Now, Richard Crook, do you imagine that you can still show your face around here when you have been two-faced? Don't come around these parts, Richard Crook, acting like you're a buddy and a friend. Remember the friend-enemy distinction. Now, I don't really emotionally care about these sorts of things, but I do care about the principle that you, sir, think that you can kind of hang out as if nothing's possible. Because on that very video, who did I see in the comments but Richard Crook? Richard Crook arguing that elite theory is essentially a homosexual pathology in which people are trying to find daddy, quote unquote. So in the rawest Anglo tradition of judgment by your peers, that is, we will have the entire chat act as the jury of your peers, Richard Crook, and we will ask the chat, should Richard Crook be allowed to stay or should he be banned? This is your democracy in action. So let's do that right now. I think it's been far too long since there was a banning on this channel. But I do not tolerate two-facedness. I do not tolerate disloyalty. I do not tolerate people who think they can be Juno-faced. You think you can talk behind the back of this community over there and then come scuttling back to my chair as if nothing has happened? You really think that, Richard Crook? Well, let's ask the audience. Should Richard Crook be banned for his ribald two-facedness? Let's have a look. Yes or no. And it's important that we resolve this right now. And he won't be able to have an argument because he will be being judged by his peers in the grandest tradition of English common law. And we would have set a precedent, wouldn't we? So, as that poll is playing out, let Blamblast continue.
The kits and counterinsurgency model. Rory's a great lad, but he's been a bit of a bull in the elite theory China shop, because much of his analysis comes from a sort of right-wing Marxian lens. To be clear, Rory is still our guy, and is friends with lots of people in the sphere, including myself, but his approach challenges the typical elite theory dogma, or at least its vulgar form, with Rory proposing a much more typically Marxist approach to understanding power, structure, and revolution. By the way, if you actually read Marx, he's not nearly as bad as what you'd expect, and certainly much better than most quote-unquote modern Marxists. He's far from perfect, of course, but his critiques of liberal capitalism and understanding of power do bear some merit. Anyway, what I have here today are two articles by Rory which challenge the elite theory right as it stands, and I thought it was well worth presenting segments from these, especially the latter, to identify what some of our problems are as a movement and what a stronger foundation could look like. Now, I must say, in the process of planning this video, I only had enough time to look at the first article, otherwise the video would be too long, so I'm splitting it into two parts, and the second part will deal with the second article. Anyway.
Now, it's worth saying that I have, I do not have that reflexive kind of dislike of Marx or the Marxist that so many rightoids have. I think he did have useful, you know, descriptive analyses. Obviously, we don't have to agree with the solutions of Marxism, but to say that Marxists have never offered anything up is silly. And in fact, next week, when we're doing Postmodernism on the Great Thinker series, I'll be talking about Guy Debord, who was a Marxist. I'll be talking about Frederick Jameson, who was a Marxist. And I've already talked about Louis Althusser, who was a Marxist. So I've talked about Lenin and Stalin in the past as well. So, yeah, there is not, I don't have that kind of low IQ rightoid reaction just because the name Marx is evoked.
Okay. I'll start with the right's Skyrim complex.
Although I should say that Marxists have always had a problem with elite theory, a problem which I think is born of Marxist cope, because, like so many other movements, Marxism wants to paint itself as a people's movement, and it wants to paint the source of power as being bottom up. So, of course, it has to come up with reason copes against the actual truth of things, which is the power always flows everywhere and always top down. They're trying to like turn that pyramid upside down. They're trying to turn that triangle, the elite theory triangle, on its head. Can they ever succeed? No. Which is why every single communist or socialist society ever has had a tight-knit elite group at the top who are extremely identifiable and called things like commissar or, you know, generalissimo or whatever else, you know. So anyway, let's carry on.
And I'll try to steel man both sides here. The right is suffering from a Skyrim complex. It imagines political power as a character creation screen. It begins with the people currently in power, turns them into a type, and then designs.
Now, I should say that there is an update. The poll is over. 201 people have voted. They have overwhelmingly decided by a ratio of 3-1 that Richard Crook should be banned. The people have spoken, and you, Richard Crook, have been found to be guilty. So under English common law tradition, you, sir, should be banned right now. However, using top-down benevolence, I decide that on this day you shall be spared, sir. You can stick around as long as you self-reflect and think. You should say to yourself every day, I shall not be two-faced anymore. I shall not be two-faced anymore. You can say that to yourself, Richard Crook, and, you know, you'll be a better person. Okay, let's carry on.
It's the opposing type. If this order favours administrators, financiers, consultants, media men and institutional functionaries, then the replacement must be disciplined, hierarchical, rooted, cultured, and strong-willed. The error is to mistake these traits for the source of power. The institutions of a society do more than employ people. They select, train, reward, and reproduce them. Administration produces administrators, just as policy work produces men who can turn interests into technical language. An economy organized around debt and claims on future income rewards the financier's cast of mind, while a system that needs its arrangements translated into moral speech will find media figures willing to do so. This does not excuse the people involved, but it does explain why they are there. Our condition is not the result of bad men wandering into office, it is the human reflection of a structure. The ruling type returns because the ruling order has the means to keep producing him. So,
now, is the crux of what Rory is saying a valid critique, right, of a Skyrim complex, the idea that you're picking someone from a character creation screen. I would say that there is a first order problem even prior to this, which has never fully been understood, but can be gleaned once again by returning to Populist Delusion, James Burnham chapter, a couple of pages in, when I asked the question, well, how does actual change happen? What, under what circumstances do you get a revolution? Under what circumstances do you see regime failure? Under what circumstances do any of these things come about? And James Burnham, or me summarizing James Burnham, outlines six different factors that need to happen for a regime to fall and for a counter-elite to, you know, come into being and take over. And of the six of them, five and a half out of the six points are basically down to the current incumbent elites. Namely, nothing to do with the people, nothing to do with counter-elites, nothing to do with external forces, everything to do with the will of the incumbent elite. Do the incumbent elite have moral unity? Are they still convicted of their own right to rule? Right? Are they still convinced of their own right to rule? Do they back themselves? Do they adapt to changing circumstances? Okay. Do they adapt to changing technologies? Have they shown themselves to be adaptable under pressure? Do they still have a will to power? All of these sorts of questions. And unfortunately, if the answer to those questions is yes, 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 and yes, the revolution ain't happening. It's just not going to happen. There has to be some failure in the elite of the existing regime class before the counter-elite even get a look in. So this in itself, I feel, has not been fully understood by people. Otherwise, we wouldn't even be getting articles like this. We wouldn't even be getting thinking along these sorts of lines. And this is something that I feel that many of the Americans never quite understood either. Many of them did not understand it. That so much is down to the people who are already in power. Now, Scrump and Evelyn get this, but almost nobody else does. That they have many, many, many levers that they can pull on. Many, like, absolute advantages across the board. Narrative framing, media control, you know, just simple, like, doing little things. Like, for example, Keir Starmer is really unpopular. What we're going to, all right, let's heap everything onto Keir Starmer, replace him with Andy Burnham. Now Andy Burnham is now actually leading in the polls against reform, okay? These are all of the absolute advantages that the regime has. They can change the tempo, right? They can do all sorts of things that you can't do when you're not in power or if you're a counter-elite, okay? They have, those are just kind of visible perception management levers, let alone things like control of the money supply, control of the electricity grid, all of these sorts of things. So it's worth remembering before we even get into the rest of their analysis here that the argument was never and has never been form a counter-elite and then you'll take over. That is too simple. And I will take people back to the very first talk I gave at one of these events years ago. I think it was the one in Nashville. I said, look, or was it even the one in the very first Witter? But that talk is now in Applied Elite Theory. I said, look, it is not a case of forming a counter-elite and then taking over. Like, that's just not going to happen in a month of Sundays. What, you're going to take on the army, take on the police, take on the security state? Are you mad? That is just not going to happen, okay? The whole idea is when you get circumstances such that the state has collapsed of its own, you know, morale failure running. Do you remember that in Baldur's Gate? Morale failure running. Well, it is possible at sometimes for the elite themselves to fall into moral disunity, for the elite themselves to stop believing in themselves, for the elite themselves to more or less implode. This is what happened in the Soviet Union. and it has happened at various times and places. You could argue that it even happened in the French Revolution, that the royalists, the Bourbon dynasty, no longer actually believed in itself, regime in Iran there, when there was the Iranian Revolution, no longer believed in itself. Okay, and if you remember in the mechanics of a counter elite takeover, what happens when a regime implodes is that it leaves a vacuum, and there'll be lots of other power groups, there'll be lots of other organized elites ready to take over. To give an applied example, in Iran, there were the Bazaaris, there were the intellectuals, there were the mullahs, of course. There were all different groups, right? All different, there were workers' groups of various different kinds, who were momentarily united in the collaboration against the existing regime, which was the Shah. What was the failure point for the Shah's regime? The army refused to fight. The army gave up on the Shah. They wouldn't shoot on the crowd. That was the moment that he lost power, and the Ayatollah came back from Paris. Okay, that was the moment. Now, and I did a whole stream on this. If you remember, what happened there is that the most organized minority, in this case the mullahs, ruthlessly eliminated all of the other groups one by one as it consolidated power. This is also a story of the Bolshevik Revolution. It is also the story of the French Revolution. It's also the story of the German Revolution that happened in the mid-century there, where counter-elite takes over in coalition with a confluence of other factors. Althusser called it overdetermination, right? A confluence of factors all moving against the ruling class at the same time, who are currently at a state of morale failure and loss of will. And in that moment, the most organized, most ruthless minority takes over. And what I was saying back then was that moment is going to be very far away. But, you know, if you ever want to have a hope in hell of being one of those possible groups that take over in the state of collapse, you need to have an organized minority. I was not saying, and I've never said, we shall become the organized minority now and overthrow the government. It's just not going to happen. It's just not going to happen. You're up against, you know, the entire, all of the stuff I say in the Populist Illusion and the 6 points of Burnham, of which only 0.5 is the discontent of the masses or the organization of the counter-elite. The counter-elite can be crushed very easily if you're up against forces that have all of those levers of the of power. So I think it's worth saying that to clarify exactly what elite theory is saying and what it is not saying. Elite theory never says, become organized, you shall take power. It just doesn't say that. Elite theory says, power always is the organized minority. If you're going to have chance of being a counter-elite that takes over in circulation, whether it's violent and revolutionary or peaceful, you have to be organized as a basic prerequisite. It doesn't say simply being organized is going to bring about the end of the current order. That's not even in the remit of your power or the sphere of your availability, if you want to put it that way. That is entirely down to the existing elite. Now, lots of people don't want to hear that because they want to cope and imagine that they have political agency themselves. Or they want to say, well, that's disempowering and it makes me feel bad. I would rather imagine a situation where I can take the kind of reins of history by the scruff of the neck. And we have the agency by, you know, but that is not, you can think that all you want. It's not actually going to change the fact that you simply do not have the power to bring about those changes most of the time. In fact, almost all of the time. If you have a look even through history, and if you want to look at prophets of doom, Arnold Toynbee and Spengler and all those guys, say, look, the Roman Empire did not fall because of barbarian invasions or because of external wars, or because it fell almost entirely due to internal loss of elite will. The failure condition of any state is the elite will of the current incumbent ruling class. If you do not think that the ruling class has given up, and I don't think that they have given up, you're still basically barking up the wrong tree, or you're playing a waiting, you're kind of biding your time. Okay, now lots of people won't want to hear that because they have a bias towards action. They want to feel empowered, so they have that they want to kind of cope and say, well, we're actually doing something here. It's not wasted energy. We're actually doing something. In a couple of weeks' time, I might return. I might do a video on Ted Kaczynski. He talked about surrogate activities. And people want to imagine that their activities are not surrogate, that they're actually real. Unfortunately, most of the time in the modern world, you're not actually engaging in real, authentic political action. You're still engaged. I mean, next Monday's video is on Guy Debord. I talk about the spectacle, hyper-reality, Baudrillard. Most of the time, you're engaged in something that is not even getting close to affecting anything at all. Because you're dealing with the simulacra, with hyper-reality, with images at the end of the day, and with narratives. And you're doing so in a position where, at best, you've got one microphone, one YouTube channel, a handful of books up against the entire mass media. So, you know, but the pen is mightier than the sword. Well, yeah, but also, I will return you. Are you going to take on the army and the police and the security state, et cetera, et cetera? Okay, anyway, let's continue.
So here, the claim is that structure comes first and structure selects for character. This may be somewhat controversial in its own right, as this doesn't by itself explain why a structure would change. And here Rory might be inclined to go into a sort of Marxist determinism, which elite theorists might recognise as being similar to the cyclical model of history. However, elite theorists likely also believe that structural change is downstream of deliberate actions of elite men. Now, someone like C.A. Bond, who doesn't call himself an elite theorist, would say that structural change happens in accordance with the Juvenalian model, which at an oversimplified level involves a struggle between a power center, which seeks to centralize power, and various subsidiaries, which seek to decentralize power, with most of history seeing the center win in this struggle. In my opinion, Bond has the best analysis here, but Rory's main point that the structure begets the men does hold true day to day and year to year. Like, you can't imagine a modern financier type existing in the medieval era, much as you can't imagine the actual King Alfred around today. In any case, let's continue. Once this, that structure begets type, is missed, politics becomes a search for superior personnel. One selects the class, chooses the traits, and enters history on the back of a horse cart as the thing selected. The answer becomes better men, better doctrine, and better taste. Yet, this only inverts the surface. The conditions that produce ruling types remain untouched. Here, we might look to aristocratic fantasy as the clearest example. Aristocracy attracts the right because it seems to contain everything the present elite lacks. Taste, inherited style, contempt for vulgarity, paternal relation to land and subject, ease with command, and indifference to commerce. Yet, aristocratic form came from aristocratic position. Manners express land, income, legal privilege, military function, marriage, strategy, and inheritance. An individual aristocrat may retain the manor after losing his land, and some do retain it.
I don't disagree with anything Rory's saying here. All of these things are more or less said by Carlyle, who says, like, look, the old aristocracy has come, been, and gone, and has basically already fallen into debauch. You're not going to get the old aristocracy back. That's why Carlyle came up with his captains of industry idea. And let's not forget, you know, all of these people have seen these things already. So in the current circumstances, what's the best you can hope for? The best you can hope for is basically a rogue elite who's turned against his own class interests, to put it in pure Marxist terms. Many people thought that was Rupert Lowe, for example, or many people thought it was Donald Trump. Whether such figures can truly turn against their class interests remains to be seen, of course. In the case of Trump, a colossal disappointment. Many people feel that way about Lowe. So maybe it's a pipe dream to ever expect the merchant to act in a non-merchant-like manner. Yet it has happened in limited forms historically. I always think that Henry Ford is a good example of somebody actually embodying Carlyle's captain of industry idea. The Bourneville family that I've mentioned before, there have been this kind of paternalistic tycoon type kind of has happened in limited forms in the past. But in a way, under current circumstances, that may be the best that one can hope for. We've been through various different avenues, haven't we, over the years? The Tony Blair type character, the right-wing Tony Blair. So rather than a Rupert Lowe-like tycoon figure, right, a businessman, rather than that, the rogue businessman, instead you look for, a managerial elite who has gone rogue. Probably the closest thing we've seen to that is Dominic Cummings, somebody like that, maybe some of those kind of tech tycoons, the source who pay to read me on Substack. I've noticed many of those kind of multi-billionaire types are slyly sub to me and pay a subscription on Substack. But again, those figures are always going to represent their own interests. They're never going to, fully represent, the interest that you have, or, be for the British people or something like that. They're going to have their own agenda, right? Unless you genuinely believe that, Cobden and Bright, genuinely believed in universal laws of the free market, and they weren't also speaking for their own sectional industrial interests at the time. Anyway, let's carry on.
But an aristocracy cannot reproduce itself without the conditions that sustain it. Yeah, this is to a large extent your basic critique of LARP, essentially. Like, you can LARP as much as you want, but without the structure the original role belonged to, you are ultimately just playing as a role, not sustainably embodying that role and reproducing that role in any meaningful sense of power. As the saying goes, the children of Windsor cannot embody the spring. But even further to this point, an actual aristocrat ripped from history and placed into modernity would not be able to propagate an aristocratic condition or an aristocratic type. Even an actual born and bred aristocrat
probably end up being arrested or put into a mental asylum or something, I'd imagine.
Would succumb to the conditions of modernity. Anyway, a man may have taste, discipline, courage, learning, and piety while possessing no material basis. He may be admirable, and he may even be a throwback, but that does not make him part of a ruling class. A ruling class is reproduced through a concrete relation to property, administration, force, production, knowledge, legitimacy, or command. Superior personalities may appear inside it, but they do not define it, nor do they explain how ruling groups maintain their position across generations. Quality is not class. The bourgeoisie and the working class are more instructive than the aristocratic fantasy because they are recent enough to be historical rather than romantic. Neither was created by men selecting traits against the feudal aristocracy. The bourgeoisie emerged through changes in commerce, technology, property, production, credit, and state power. And
I mean, what one thing I would say is that the current powers that be definitely prefer the right when it's grug, like low IQ, grug tier, right? It doesn't like the right when it's intelligent. It doesn't like the right when it's kind of, you know, been to university, as it were, which is why I think it always has a permanent incentive to push Tommy Robinson and Gammon, Zilla, and, you know, populism, and to promote the worst kind of instincts, and even to some extent Bronze Age pervert and people like that, who is intelligent but also, you know, has a kind of aesthetic, kind of meme aesthetic, right? Andrew Tate. I think the system deliberately promotes some of these sorts of figures because it finds the idea of an intelligent, well-read, cultured, quote-unquote right-wing, somewhat disconcerting. But more importantly than that, it doesn't like the idea of educated men and women coming across, for example, somebody like me, who's a reasonable guy, who's calm, who's not frothing at the mouth, who's well-read, clearly credentialed, and so on, and basically saying that the current worldview is just full of nonsense, right? It's just rubbish. It doesn't like that. It prefers the neat, already-made box that it can already fit people into, which is why I've always told people, wherever possible, deny their frame. Deny their frames, deny their dialectical traps. You know, don't become the thing that they want you to be. Defy. But can people do that? No. So I think that their narrative frame control is actually very effective, and it just keeps, you know, it keeps the right absolutely retarded on purpose. You know, such that, you know, anybody who's got anything about them, let's say, you know, from the professional classes, which, let's face it, would include me, it would include Blamblast, it would include Scrump, for example, will eventually just get frustrated, disillusioned, and be like, yeah, I can't be part of this thing because it's just stupid. And I've seen that phenomena. There's that guy John Arcto, right? These are all people who are exactly of the type that they don't want representing the quote-unquote right. You know, they would much rather it be populist, grug brain, low IQ, stupid, Zoomer historian type. Right, it much prefers that mold, and so it shall be, because, like I said, there's only so much that is in the purview of your power, whereas they have quite a lot of levers they can pull. They're very good at setting the frame. I mentioned Scrump. They did a stream recently, Scrump and Evelyn, called Sensationalism. I'd recommend everybody check that out, where they talked about just how extraordinary the ability of the system to set the frame is, right? Things like Anne Whittaker, the murder of Anne Whittaker, right? Or, you know, the change from Starmer to Burnham. Look at all of the things they managed to achieve through that. And as long as the bulk of the you know, the so-called influencers are made up of grug tier fucking thick as minced populists, they will just do the bidding of the official narrative again and again, right? That is just what it is. And the people who won't go along with it, like Scrump and Evelyn, will be despised and rejected. Despised and rejected. Sorry, Scrump. Love you, but you know that you are despised and rejected because the people don't want to hear, you know, signal jams or counter signals or anybody describing what is. They want comforting, delusions and illusions or narratives that make sense to them. I believe it was Nietzsche who said men don't want the truth, they want comforting illusions. And that's why elite theory triggers the responses that it does, because nobody's really set up for it. And go back to that video I made on George Sorel. Myth is so much more powerful in motivating men. People want their delusions, they want their dreams. And so let them have it. Let them have it. Anyway, let's continue.
And the working class emerged through dispossession, wage labor, industrialization, and dependence on the sale of labor. Each became conscious of itself only after the material relation had taken shape. In each case, the type followed the position. The Skyrim complex treats historically produced characters.
Well, the guy in the chat saying that Zuma historian is not stupid, I mean, all right, I'm waiting for any evidence of that whatsoever, because, I mean, you know, I even now I'm not on Twitter anymore. Somebody I saw it just happened somehow on Substack, come across my thing that somebody had kind of posted a little screenshot of him, it is the most perfect encapsulation of Twitter brain I've ever seen. Right, this is right to descent on Substack. The rising tide of rightoidism sinks all boats. Zoom historian, quote from an hour ago. The radicalization of Elon Musk, or at least his parroting of our views, shows that people just swim in the same waters as us, then gradually they'll soon become us. Bodes well for the future when every voter is heavily online. So you can tell me in the chat there that he's not stupid, but what was it Jesus said? What did Jesus say? Judge them by their fruits. And there he is in 2026, saying with a straight face that, oh yeah, Elon Musk is one of us. As things become more and more heavily online, we, quote unquote, will control blah, 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 blah. So, anyway, let's continue.
As an attribute that can be chosen. Okay, if we're going to talk about the development of character types like the bourgeoisie and the working class, I much prefer the Bondian / Juvenalian model to the Marxian model, but that's largely beside the point. Point is, people are products of their time, and it's silly to pretend you can be anything otherwise, hard as you might try. I actually think this hard-to-swallow pill also casts doubt over the would-be enlightened Evolians too. Like, sure, you can have your enlightened aristocratic soul, but ultimately, you've still got to stack the shelves, Wagey. Anyway, all of this so far is secondary to the real target of the two articles, which is the apparent cargo cult of organization with...
I probably shouldn't let that little... I know it's beside the point of the stream here, but, if you truly embody the aristocrat of the soul, quote unquote, it doesn't really matter if you're stacking the shelves or what you're doing for work, because you will have the internal, you kind of internally will have transformed yourself sufficiently that it just doesn't bother you anymore. You've kind of become strong enough not to react, blam blas. Can you embody the principle of non-reaction? This is the ultimate irony, really, because Evola is seen as this arch, quote-unquote, reactionary. But his old doctrine is, don't react. Can you not react? Now, think about this. If everybody watching this stream and everybody who has a Rightoid YouTube channel or Twitter account truly embodied the Evolian man. The response to Christopher Nolan's Odyssey would have been a studied silence. Wouldn't have just say nothing. Don't go and watch it. Don't give it oxygen. Mike from Imperium Press wrote an extraordinarily good article about reiterating points I'd made in my old video, Dialectics and No Dialogue. You know, how you pick and choose your shots. You don't have to be giving energy to Christopher Nolan's Odyssey, because whether you hated it or loved it, the fact that you're talking about it redirects energy back into the thing and it helps the system. Now, in your hypothetical Evolian world, if enough people embodied that principle en masse, the thing would be stripped of its power because everybody is embodying Evolian non-reaction. Now, Evola was realist as well. He said, look, you're never going to get the masses to do this because they are literally the unwashed plebeian mass. They are the pigs who love their slop. You're never going to do it. That is why it is an aristocratic principle, because only a small amount of people will ever achieve the principle of non-reaction. That is what Evola was talking about. And, you know, you can scoff at it, but the fact is, even the bloke stacking the shelves, if he's able to not react, he's in a better place than the guy on tens and thousands of pounds, right, making slop YouTube videos, if that person making the YouTube videos is genuinely caught in the dialectical trap of perpetual reaction. Again, I will direct people to Scrump and Evelyn, who have videos and essays in their book, Anti-Politics, about the endless conversation and starving the endless conversation, refusing to take part in the endless conversation. Imagine the conservative with his little speck, you know, with his little conservative Tory boy spectacle face. Oh, that's not in the interests of open and free fair dialogue. Oh, yeah, blah, blah. And just sticking your boot, smash it, like literally stick your boot straight through that guy's face. And say, look, I am not talking about this at all. Nothing can be, I'm not taking part in the endless conversation. End of. If you can do that, it would be better. So that is what Evola was talking about. Anyway, that's a bit of a tangent. I noticed that the time is creeping up. We're going to have to finish up soon.
Been the elite theory right. The same error appears in the fixation on organization. The target here is not elite theory as such, but its simplified popular form, which reasons backwards from the visible traits of the ruling group. The present elite appears cohesive, disciplined, strategic, and institutionally placed. Therefore, the answer is imagined as a cohesive, disciplined, strategic, and institutionally placed counter-elite. This is better than the belief in the populist illusion that mass feeling alone moves history, since it at least understands discipline, coordination, and placement, yet it still evades the central question, an organised minority of what? Yeah, what Rory's saying here is that vulgar elite theorists, the people who agree with the basic principles of the theory but lack a full understanding, treat power as a sort of cargo cult of organisation. Powerful groups are well organized, therefore well organized groups are powerful. Seems simple enough, but I think it's wrong.
Yeah, I'd say I agree with that. I think it's self-evident. Just self-evident. An elite theory never said that simply being organized confers power. Obviously, there's so much more to it. You just have to read again. If people actually read Populist Illusion, they'd know all of this already. Watch the video on Robert Michel's I made a couple of weeks back, or read the chapter on Michel's and the Iron Oligarchy and why it's not as simple as simply being organized. They've got so many absolute advantages, levers they can pull. So it was never a question of simply being organized. as I've been stressing throughout this video.
I did a video a while ago called The Alarming Nature of True Power, and in that, I looked at some far more consequential forms of power.
Blam blas, Evelo is more than simply don't get rage baited. If you embody the Evolian aristocrat of the soul, then you are sufficiently at inner peace, right? You are sufficiently balanced in and of yourself, in mind, body, and spirit, that you are unmovable. So it's not simply not being rage baited. Like, for example, you could look at the Odyssey thing and be like the that Wojak who's kind of got the smiling face, but he's seething underneath, right? Now, you could be that and not make a tweet about it and use your self-control to keep your statements to yourself, right? But the fact is, you're still seething. The fact is, you're still being affected because you're seething under that mask. The Evolian new man, or let's just say somebody in alignment with their higher self, just wouldn't be affected by it. It'd bounce off you like a bullet bounces off Superman. This is the true meaning of Ride the Tiger and men Among the Ruins. It's not even about not giving in to the emotion. You're just almost kind of serenely above it, if that makes any sense. And through that, there is a certain power that really kind of exposes the fact that the system kind of needs both sides. The system, like Christopher Nolan's Odyssey, needs outraged chuds, basically. It needs chuds reacting to it. It needs bigots. It needs people to point the finger at. And right-wingers need shrieking feminist harpy type to rage at. So they need each other. And every new story that comes along is stuck through this mill. Let's go back to Scrump and Evelyn on Anne Whittingham. Now, yeah, it was tragic that Anne Whittingham was killed. Yes, guy was a nutter and it was a bad thing. And I liked her on Strictly Come Dancing, yada, yada, yada. But that's not the point. The point is, what are you going to do with this narrative? Right? And most people have chose to willingly feed it through the slop mill into existing, culture war slop, essentially. Right? What's a way of doing that? Oh, they want to kill you. They, the left, the boogeyman left, want to kill you, chud. You, chud, them left. Chud versus left. Crazy leftist versus you, the chud. And again, who benefits from this narrative? Why does this narrative exist? Why is it encouraged? Why is it pushed along? Why does it attract all the likes and the clicks and all the rest of it? And again, if you're going to be actually fit to lead anything, you should actually not be kind of swept along on those tides of emotion, as so many people are. You should be able to stand apart and not be affected by any of it and not feed into any of it. This is more than simply don't get rage baited. It is about a complete self-transformation such that you're basically a new person, different. You're in balance, as it were. If you read Evola's Handbook for Right-Wing Youth, he says, look, you guys are not going to get anywhere, basically. None of you are going to get anywhere because you're all like emotional children. You're like teenage girls. You're too full of chud energy. You just have no hope of doing anything because you lack discipline and control and self-mastery. That's what Evola's talking about. But anyway, let's continue.
blackmail, violent force, threat of strike, denial of service, so on and so forth. Power there was framed as ultimately being a matter of perceived destructive capacity, perceived being used to account for the capacity to bluff. There is a positive side too, of course, perceived capacity for benefits, but this is lesser than destruction. But no, as for the matter of organization, I do not think organization in and of itself equals power, but that power rests on perceived capacity for destruction and or benefit. But let me give an analogy. You can have a very well-organized chess group. The group can have 100 core members with an audience of a million. It can arrange tournaments, host conferences, sell books and courses, or even design a chess app. But the chess group...
I would suggest that chess group would be more powerful than the entire quote-unquote dissident right, online right, populist slop right. All of them combined would probably have less power than that chess group.
As organised as it is, will never topple Parliament or displace the international finance elites.
I tell you who has more power than even the chess group, let alone the online right, is Mumsnet. Mumsnet is a powerful force. If you were able to organise Mumsnet, they could be a genuine force for radical change, I would say. Mumsnet, they're a very powerful group, I would say.
Therefore, organisation by itself is not power. Does this mean elite theory is wrong? No. Does this mean organisation is not what's needed? Again, no. Does this mean that the efforts of right-wing groups that have done great work in becoming organised and setting up various entities and outlets are wasted? Again, categorically, no, and Rory isn't saying that either.
Seriously, Mumsnet is a rival castle that sporadically needs to be placated by the regime. The regime fears Mumsnet. What Rory and Blamblash should do, sack off all this online right nonsense. Try to get in there on Mumsnet and be like, try to organize the mums on there. That'd be the thing to do.
It simply means that to be powerful, organization must revolve around something consequential. Farming, energy, infrastructure, military, transport, anything that society relies upon. Organization matters when it gathers a group with leverage. A priesthood, an officer corps, a creditor class, an industrial class, a technical layer, or a strategic workforce.
Yeah, what does Mumsnet control, though? Mumsnet controls the means of reproduction. The means of reproduction, right? They control kind of like... There's a lot to say for the kind of hennish... safety first woman, like women getting ideas into their heads. It's not very, the internet's not very safe for children, is it? Oh, we need to ban social media for under 16. So this sort of energy, powerful. In a way, Mary Whitehouse, if she existed today, would have been an absolute tour de force on Mumsnet. Don't underestimate it. It's a strong force in society.
Matters because society depends on what it controls, commands, or performs. Its importance comes from social function, from its place in the working of the whole. Organization does not create political power from will. It gives form, continuity, and direction to a force history has already made. A lorry driver may have more latent political significance than a social media personality. The same may be true of a grid engineer, port worker, rail worker, warehouse worker, or server technician, because they sit closer to the logistical and technical joints of society than men with better opinions. There is no sentimentality in this point.
Yeah, I mean, all of this stuff is true, but this is just like, well, these are already kind of power groups in society. And many of them are already unionized. And many of those unions are already captured. So it's like, yeah, I mean, it's true. These would be ideal nodes to that you'd need for any revolution to take place, right? You'd need to capture these nodes. You'd have to be a lorry driver, wouldn't you? Or you'd have to be part of the Engineers Guild, or you'd have to, you'd have to actually be part of those groups already, or attract those groups, or infiltrate them in some way. We're just a bunch of, I'm just an academic online who frankly has no interest in political organization whatsoever. So, yeah, I mean, theoretically, the point Rory's making is true. But it's also very far away from, I would suggest, basically has no chance of, let's just pretend I was interested in political organization myself. And I'm like, right, I'm going to set my mind now on taking over the lorry drivers union. How on earth would I go about doing that from my vantage point? One, not being a lorry driver, two, having absolutely no knowledge of the lorry driving industry. Three, I mean, you see, it's like it would take quite a lot. I'm not going to say it's impossible because, where there's a will, there's a way. But, you're still talking about, as the Americans would say, a Hail Mary pass and then some. So, yeah, I understood what Rory's saying is structurally true. But whether you're going to bring about those changes from, this little corner of the internet is, I would suggest, very far-fetched indeed. Very far-fetched.
A man is not politically holy because he drives a lorry, and ordinary people are not wise. The point is that order survives because food arrives, energy flows, goods move, payments clear, code runs, and machines are maintained. The people involved may be passive, liberal, conservative, selfish, decent, brave, or cowardly. Their character is irrelevant. The point is that their position touches the reproduction of society in a way opinion does not. Yeah, indeed, it's a basic enough premise. Society relies upon certain foundations to operate. Indeed, Scrump and Evelyn go one further by saying that a lot of these roles fall under a so-called conservative given space, wherein only men of native stock and conservative mind would be willing and able to work these jobs. In my own video, also titled The Conservative Given, I say that these men, if wielded by an elite, could serve as an excellent bargaining chip to ransom against the state. Imagine your right-wing energy union saying, deport the Boris wave or the lights go out. If you've got the capacity and cohesion to hold that line, you've got great leverage, far more than a self-styled counter-elite in a parallel society. To give the elite theorists their due...
I mean, all of this is true in the theoretical world that you can capture that node. And this has been, the more successful rebellions in history, Magna Carta, for example, and various others that I've talked about, force concessions. They force concessions because power has to make a deal. But then what happens, if you recall, and this is basic containment 101, is they don't just kind of give you what you want, they co-opt you and bring you in as well, right? So those, the base energy union, they'd be like, okay, well, we'll do some deportations. We hear you, we hear you, princess of our hearts. We hear you, but also we're going to bring you in. Also, you're going to become kind of part of this little club now. And that's what the British state has always done. It just kind of brings it in. And, with these kind of critical infrastructure, critical or energy critical sectors and industries, I'd imagine that they were brought in, quote unquote, a long time ago. Right. So now it's a much more difficult prospect because it's already been captured. It's already part of the regime, if you want. So this is something else that is with. It's not like these things are just free floating entities waiting to be captured by you. They're already captured. They're already regime compliant, regime controlled, regime, in which case, you're talking about flipping a castle, which is easier said than done.
However, identifying the leverage of the men in Vital Industry, whilst true, does say nothing about the incentives of the existing elites or what should be installed in their place. Rather, it merely points out a structural vulnerability. A true counter-elite would still need an alternative framework and, in the ensuing struggle to maintain power, would benefit greatly from a safe platform offered by parallel institutions. So the efforts of groups building such frameworks and institutions are by no means wasted. This article should not be read as an attack on any large network doing these things, but instead an attack on the cargo cult mentality of the idea of power flowing from mere organization, and any organization which does not involve these nodes of great leverage should accept freely both the benefits and limitations.
Now, I suspect that I am not the target of this video from Blamblast and the original essay from Rory. I suspect they have other people in mind. Who believes in this cargo cult? Who has this mentality? I mean, maybe they've got some of the Americans in mind. Maybe they've got some of the actual organizers of, you know, these various institutions that they're talking about in mind. I don't really know who they've got in mind, but I get the impression that I am not actually the target of this. I thought it would be fun to review it, though, and have that thumbnail. So, you know, here we are.
It can provide. Anyway, carrying on. Yet, even this leverage does not become politics by itself. A strategically placed group can go on performing its function without ever seeing it as power. The existing order has developed extensive legal, cultural, and administrative means to keep such groups fragmented and obedient. The driver remains a driver, the teacher a teacher, the engineer an engineer, the farmer a farmer. Each knows his pressure point as work, grievance, local knowledge, or private resentment, while the ruling order depends on these functions being scattered, habitual, and obedient. Organization matters because it allows scattered dependents to act as a force. Now, as we have seen, unions in our past have not led to revolution and have instead been folded into the establishment, with union leaders effectively being paid off by the state, reduced to mere beggars. This is not to say, however, that the organization of these people cannot be done. They are still vitally important to the maintenance of the state and society, and according to Scrump and Evelyn, the men in conservative given spaces cannot meaningfully be replaced. As such, in theory, it would be possible to organize these men and remain uncompromising in the struggle against the state, provided the men were given sufficient ideological justification and faith in the success of the organization's goals. As such, this is actually a space where it's not over, and will never be over. The state may seek to criminalize organizations in these spaces, and nobody's saying it's easy, but a weakened state in a time of crisis likely could be overturned by such action. Anyway, vulgar elite theory sees that rule is carried out by an organized minority, then treats organization itself as the source of rule.
Yeah, I'm still interested to know. I mean, maybe Rory or Blamblast could shoot me a DM or an email explaining who they actually have in mind here. You know, I can think of a few possible candidates for quote-unquote vulgar elite theorists, but I cannot imagine they mean me here, so.
The group is imagined as a freestanding actor, as if cohesion and strategy explain its power. Organization becomes another selected trait to the character build. The character sheet expands from hierarchy, religion, and will to cadre formation, placement, and strategic patience. Power is still being explained by the qualities of the people who hold it, rather than by the process that produced them. A serious account starts from the other end and asks what conditions produced the present rulers, what forms of property and administration sustain them, which older forces have been dissolved, which new forces have been created, and where the daily reproduction of society now depends. This is the beginning of action.
It's worth saying that this idea of Rory's is not purely Marxoid. It is presupposed also by Mosca. Mosca talks about social forces, right? Social comfort, and he says new elites rise when there's been a reconfiguration of social forces. So for example, you know, the tech bros, a lot of talk was, well, they may be a new configuration, a new social force. And, you know, over the past 10 years, we've seen their attempts to enter politics, you know, whether as a counter elite or as a co-opted, maybe they've been co-opted now, or maybe they failed or whatever. But basically, the system is trying to deal with this as a new kind of arrangement. And I don't think the elite theorists would say that is untrue, that certain material changes in technology and material circumstances can bring about a change in who the power brokers are. I don't think there's anything in elite theory that disagrees with this basic idea.
Not because analysis is action by itself, which it obviously is not, but because political will matters only when joined to a group able to act on that dependence. Without that basis, it becomes theatre, doctrine, a social club, or self-promotion. Now, this is where Rory really goes against the approach of the general...
That's a very, very polite way, Bambas, of saying gay club. When you said social club, what you really meant is gay club, didn't you? Be honest, that's what you meant, because that's what it is 9 times out of 10.
Elite theory, right. Certainly, we see a lot of subscribers to elite theory do little more than posture as though they can and potentially will become the great organisers of the revolution, but they never actually do so. However, is this to say that it's impossible for a freestanding vanguard to organise the masses? Well, perhaps not literally impossible, no, but a realistic assessment of the will and action of men would show that bonds of ideology are weak against the direct bonds of dependent relationships. For example, someone might say that they support the movement, but that they're not willing to lose their job over it, which is why we have so many anons. But yes, without the means to fire, punish, threaten, reward, and provide sanctuary for people, even the best quality men would not find themselves able to convince the masses to get behind them. To actually have real leverage, you need to get into nodes of real dependence. A counter-elite, if the term is worth using, becomes effective only when it gives conscious form to a social force the existing order has produced, but can no longer contain in the old way. Here, the class base remains a base, not a guarantee.
I mean, I would stress that Juvenal gives us the model for understanding how this process actually works. And it doesn't really work most of the time through dissident action. Right? It doesn't work through dissident action most of the time. It works through what I have called in Populist Delusion and in Applied Elite Theory, the newly elevated bureaucrat becoming its own rival castle. Okay. For example, Thomas Cromwell becoming a rival castle to Henry VIII, thereby becoming intolerable to Henry VIII and being killed by Henry VIII. Or Claudine Gay, the woke president of Harvard and black activist and various other wokesters becoming newly elevated bureaucrats and then becoming an intolerable rival castle to Zionist billionaires who then had them systematically fired and removed, etc., etc., etc. That is typically how it has worked. Now, if the power center in the Juvenalian model does not act swiftly to demolish the rival castle, then the rival castle can genuinely start becoming a problem and start challenging the center. This is historically been when civil wars break out or where you get true elite infighting. Shakespeare once said, "Hark, what discord follows." But notice, this happened in a process almost on its own. It required no intervention from dissidents or from, actors who believe that they can affect the outcome of things, you know, through their own collective efforts. And, you know, again, it's like, well, this sounds very defeatist or futile or whatever, but this is almost like the number one lesson that Scrump and Evelyn have been trying to give for the past 2 years, which is like, look, you've got to understand how little, like, you're not really going to be able to affect these forces because they're so much bigger than you in the remit of your power. So you're probably better off going down the pub, having a game of snooker, and trying to affect change in much smaller areas that you probably can do something about, which is not going to be a surrogate activity in the Uncle Ted mold, right? Like, for example, I don't know, trying to save your local church, or, you know, trying to do something about the litter problem. But of course, that is boring. Nobody wants to do that because that's like really, really quite dull. You know, frankly, I don't want to do it. But again, I have no interest in actual political organization. I am a scholar. And, you know, in a way, scholars are, quote unquote, useless, right? In so much as they describe things that are happening, they give analytical descriptions, and sometimes they can give moral prescriptions. But that is the start and the end of their input. They don't do anything more than that. But that is the difference between a political activist or a political organizer and a theorist. Now, you could say that there is the role for, you know, to get back to our Marxism, the Bolsheviks got somewhere because they had theorists and they had men on the ground who were great organizers. And, you know, they had a division of labor within themselves. Some people were great at the organization and some people were good at the theorizing and, you know, and so on and so forth. You know, and a slightly different job is the dissemination of theoretical ideas to the normal men, things like that. Stalin actually was a hands-on man, kind of a man on the ground as opposed to a theorist. Whereas someone like Bukharin was a pure theorist, the editor of Pravda later on. You know, just so happens that Stalin ended up killing Bukharin, but you can cross that bridge when it comes.
It does not decide politics on its own. Organization must attach itself to a real social position, and that position can become decisive only when the existing order begins to depend on forces it can no longer command easily. Structural crisis matters because it exposes that dependence and shows where command rests. It does not, however, produce victory by itself. Crises can be and are wasted, repressed, or captured. Crises create an opening in which organization may give a real social force political direction.
All right, so we're about 20 minutes in. Unfortunately, in the interest of time, I'm going to have to, because I have to drive back and be back by 6, and there's traffic at this time of day. I have to go on the M25 and all sorts. So because of that, I'm going to have to call time on this. I'll read the super chats. We will come back to this unless some massive news event happens. We'll come back to this next week, finish up and do the second video next Tuesday. This can be a two-parter, and maybe I'll do an even better. Maybe Rory can send me a picture where I can give him a kind of left hook this time if he's willing. Or maybe I'll just do another one of Blam Blast getting his lights out. Just a bit of fun, of course. Let us have a look at Super Chats. Max Rockatansky says, the missus bought me a 16-volume complete Carlyle set from 1897. We have a busy year ahead. Thanks for giving your audience better taste. Fantastic. I think I know the set. Good reading, sir. Good reading. Since Brecken says, here is £5. As a patron, I demand justice. Ban Richard! Look at that, Richard Crook. You have now become... You are now reproducing the conditions of King Edward, where the loyal subjects are actually trying to give me money to get rid of you. And yet still in my benevolence, I say, Richard Crook has seen the error of his ways and has been rehabilitated. He has engaged in self-criticism and has come back to the flock. So, you know, while I'm grateful, since Bracken, on this occasion, Richard can stay. John Darrow says, knowledge isn't power. Power is power. I swear I heard that somewhere. Yes, that was indeed on Game of Thrones. It was said by Cersei Lannister, of all people, where Littlefinger goes, "Oh, knowledge is power," and then she just gets him arrested and says, "Power is power." Brilliant moment in Game of Thrones. And of course, Cersei's right until she comes up against a mad bitch with a massive dragon who basically torches King's Landing and burns it to the fucking ashes. Cersei Lannister is right. Power is power. And then she comes a cropper with the bigger... Basically, she comes up against somebody with nukes. That's what happens in Game of Thrones. Cthulhu Rise says, even Shilua Hendrix is part of their frame. Do you know what, Cthulhu? I don't even know what Shilua Hendrix is. Is that Jimi Hendrix's like granddaughter or something? Who's Shilua Hendrix? John says, AA, Rory deals with your futility point in the next essay. He is not putting across a program. He is explicitly pessimistic about this. We'll do that one next week. I actually think that we probably end up agreeing more than we disagree, right? Agreeing more than we disagree. But it's fun to, give the simulacra of internet blood sports in order to, trick people into engaging their brains for an hour or two. There have been some super thanks as well in the past week, which I shall quickly deal with. If I can find them. Okay. So, on Michael Oakeshott video, The Limits of Rational Planning, Peter Vander Get Jag says thanks. Well, thank you very much, sir. Jackson on the Daniel Kahneman video says, hear me out here. I think the educational videos have been a massive positive turn for the channel in the past few months. What I would like to see is more analysis and discussion on each thinker that you talk about. What this would look like is either longer videos or multiple videos on whatever character of the week is. How the reward turns out is a more in-depth look of whatever ideas, richer viewer engagement, and not least importantly, AA will not run out of people to talk about anytime soon. Thanks for the content as always. Well, when it comes to running out of people, I just don't see any shortage of people to talk about pretty much ever. I mean, I haven't even scratched the surface of various people to talk about yet. At some point I may break out to go more in depth on certain things, or you know, it may be that when one cycle runs out, we'll come back to revisit something that's only touched on, you know, in a video. That's the beauty of it. We can kind of do what we want here, you know. So I hear you, Jackson. Friend Them in Church says, so this is on last week's Deepest Law with Andy, no, last week's Office Hours about Andy Burnham culling the cabinet. He says, on the BBC commercials, I'm surprised no one commented on the change from the shared experience. What has the BBC ever done for us versus the modern atomized individual for me? Yeah, that was on Deepest Law when we were looking at that horrible BBC commercial with that Indian comedian on it. And it's true. He says, what has the BBC ever done for me? Whereas the John Cleese one says, what has ever done for us? Very, very good point, friend of Minchurch. On the Otto Weininger video from yesterday, JDA says, my friend is in the army. His regiment got their first female officer ever, and within 2 weeks, she slept with her platoon sergeant. When this blew up, she blamed him for, quote-unquote, exploiting her, despite being his commander. Additionally, a while ago, you made a video about a historical location in Poland. What tier of membership do I need to be able to watch this again, if possible? Probably on the Thomas Sowell tier, I would say. promising on the probably on the top tier. And in terms of the friend in the army, I am not surprised at all to hear that story. Discover the Secrets of the Eight Schools of the Right, an old video for me, an old classic from a couple of years back. The Eight Schools of the Right, still worth watching. Will any of the following people appear on your Thinker series videos, AA? E. Michael Jones, Jonathan Bowden, David Irving, Kevin MacDonald, Rollo Tomassi, Vox Day, and Edward Dutton. Probably not. Probably not. I guess Irving is a historian for one, so he doesn't, I don't really think he's, historians are that good for having 10 ideas in that way. They're all a little bit too specific, I guess would be the thing. Then they're kind of getting at something very specific. So I wouldn't even know if there would be 10 ideas in there in each case. I mean, what are the 10 ideas? That's something I'd have to think about. But yeah, Bowden would probably be the most interesting one. But Bowden really was a disseminator of other people's ideas. He had one or two interesting ideas of his own. But even those are probably downstream of Nietzsche in some way. So, you know, Kevin MacDonald, yeah, he's got his big, you know, the big thesis that he's got. But at the end of the day, what's his worldview? He's still basically a kind of libertarian, as far as I can tell. Kind of like a racist libertarian in terms of his basic worldview. Am I wrong? Last time I heard him talk, he just sounded like any other boomer, to be honest. So it's like, you know, I have to... I want to cover people that offer something a bit different, if that makes any sense. I feel like people wouldn't really be learning much if it was any of these figures. You know, E. Michael Jones, probably E. Michael Jones's most interesting material is on porn, related to what J.D. Unwin was talking about in today's video. That's probably his, but you know, what is E. Michael Jones's basic worldview? It's just basically like Catholicism at the end of the day. It's like Catholicism, and he doesn't like one group of people. It's like, okay, but you know, I need to try to. I don't know. I don't find it that interesting. It doesn't seem to kind of tick the. I don't really know what my criteria is for the Great Thinkers series, but I go through and it's like, yeah, this one feels right. This one doesn't feel right. You know, I wanted to do a week on ideas of communal living, right? Communal living. And I was like, who shall I name? Eric Fromm. Tick. He sounds like a good one. Eric Fromm. I'm interested in him. Hilaire Belloc. Yeah, I'll give a tick to Hilaire Belloc. Alistair McIntyre. Doesn't feel right. Now, I can't quantify why I say yes to Belloc, yes to Fromm, but no to Alistair McIntyre. But I don't know. I've got an intuition of who feels right and who feels wrong. And to me, Alistair McIntyre doesn't quite fit. To be honest, Michael Oakeshott was a borderline case. He was on the cusp. But on balance, I was like, yeah, Oakeshott's in. But there's a borderline there. But Alistair McIntyre's out. But then again, never say never. Never say never. All right. I think that is it in terms of, Chesterton is a possibility. Chesterton a possibility. But I'd have to see, like, what does Chesterton say that Belloc doesn't? Belloc's got interesting ideas about all sorts of things. What does Chesterton think that Belloc doesn't? That's a genuine question. Maybe any Chesterton fans could have a look at that. I'm not an automatic rule out for Chesterton, though. right? He doesn't feel like it. I feel like he could be justified. But there are other theorists I'm interested in. I'm trying to remember that guy who wanted to bring back guilds. He would be of more interest, I would say. There was a guy in the early 20th century who wanted to bring back guilds. Forget his name. It'll come to me. All right. That is it, ladies and gentlemen. That is it. I will see you all next week. Goodbye. Go on, get out.
What goes on in this town is none of your business.
As long as I'm living here, it is.
Then maybe you shouldn't be living here!
Well, that's easily fixed.